history. It's a very, very funny thing. History has always been infused in aspects of white supremacy. In eighth grade, I remember being so excited. One, I was going to watch The Killing Field, a movie about the Khmer genocide. And two, I was going to get the opportunity to open up history books and read about my history. There's no mention of Khmer people in history other than history of genocide. I think I was excited because people were going to actually get to see or learn something about my history. And if it was even related to something so horrid, I was okay with it. Because for that one moment in time, I wasn't invisible. And then 9/11 happened. I didn't get a chance to read about my people or watch movies about my people because we spent most of the eighth grade being gaslighted to believe that brown people were terrorists. Yes, there was a terror attack by terrorists. That's not what I am saying. The teachers kept showing us photos of brown people and kept repeating the word terrorist. This is what a terrorist looks like. This is a terrorist. Terrorist, 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 terrorist. By the time we knew it, we were terrorized into believing that brown people were terrorists. I had brown skin. I was terrorized because people were mean. Kids are horrible people. They bullied me. They've always bullied me for something. But now there was something new that they could use to call me a terrorist. And I didn't really... I mean, it faded over time as we started integrating both Bosnian and Somali communities. A lot of the grunt of racism was kind of shared now between us in such a way where I got to experience the contrast of refugees from both whiteness and blackness and everything in between, and the various lived experiences that comes with the territory. But as an adult, now that I fly to various parts. My husband and I fly probably once or twice a year. We've been flying for almost the last 13 years. And every single time, I get stopped because I was quote unquote pre-selected for a screening. And my white husband just so oblivious to the fact that I was being targeted for the color of my skin. But I don't let that bother me because I could be terrorized for much worse. So I always created a system where I put my hands out, let them rub the little slip of thing, whatever it is, to see if I have bomb residue on my hands before they even talk about consent to grope me. I provide them consent. It saves them time. It saves me time. And over time, my husband created a process, a system that gathered my things, untied my shoes, just made sure that by the time I was finished being groped, I could put my shoes on, get it tied, get my belt on, get everything together so that we have enough time to get to our flight. And that's the type of things that persons of color have to face. We face different aspects of oppression, but we have to deal with things that white people don't. History repeats itself. Or, if you're friends with Mark Twain, history rhymes. January 6, 2021, we got the opportunity to observe history in the making. We got to see Donald Trump incite a mob to storm a building in DC and look for blood. We got to see a congresswoman live tweet the location of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. We got to see individuals attacking the DC police. And the most disturbing thing is we got to see the DC police do nothing. See, when I was standing there during the height of the Black Lives Matter rally in Des Moines, Iowa, I got to see the beauty of protest. I got to see the Des Moines police trigger and like, it was just watching that, just watching them become the aggressor and utilize things like tear gas. In a lot of places, in a lot of states, people were just standing there demanding basic human rights, and were met with rubber bullets. But here these people were, these white terrorists, storming a building looking to take lives from Congress people. I just cannot grasp that. But as we were watching history unfold, we're now seeing Republican politicians attempting to rewrite history in the image of whiteness, in the image of white supremacy. They're trying to push the conversation away from the fact that Donald Trump incited a riot. These people are terrorists, and we need to treat them as such. Now, when I look at what happened, when I look at the ideology, and when I look at Donald Trump and everything that's happened in the last 4 years, I keep saying that he's like Pol Pot. I still do. But the people that are out there, the QAnon supporters, the QAnon, the conspiracy theorists, they're not quite like the Khmer Rouge. I see them as a hybrid of both Khmer Rouge, Nazi Party. And when I started to try to frame the complexity of the human psychology or the mob mentality, I started seeing that, you know what, Mark Twain, you're right. History maybe doesn't repeat itself, but it sure as hell rhymes. And I spent all my life trying to figure out how the hell the Khmer Rouge were capable of killing their own people. How Pol Pot was able to influence a coup and massacre millions of people. See, we are really good at understanding genocide through the lens of the Holocaust. I mean, we have that day of remembrance, the day of the, you know, learning about the atrocities the Nazi Party has done, and learning about why we should take charge to fix and make sure that history does not rhyme. That we do things like read the books of Anne Frank, but we don't really have that critical self-reflection about how we could prevent something like this from ever happening again. And if we allow the Republican Party to rewrite history for generations to come to not understand exactly what happened, we're going to repeat it. And the rhymes might not be pretty the next time around. So let's take a dive into the history of Cambodia and understand what exactly happened with the Khmer Rouge. This is De Facto. My name is Tony Kuhn. So today's episode, I wanted to talk about Pol Pot. So Pol Pot is one of the dictators that created, well, I mean, I wouldn't say created a genocide, but essentially responsible for one of the genocides that happened in the latter half of the century. Now, one of the faults in my stars is that I have a beautiful mind. I have a friend that says, you know, Tony, every time you talk, I get college credit. But one of the biggest struggles that I have is years. I'm really bad with dates. So I do apologize beforehand for the scholars out there, like, and say, oh crap, he's giving the wrong year. So I'm good. I try my best, but I'm really bad with years. I'm really bad with dates. I mean, I had my husband think that he was 40 for like the longest time. And then on his actual 40th birthday, he was like, what the hell? I just turned 40 and I thought that I was 40. So that's how bad I am with years. So anywho, let's get to the topic of Pol Pot. So he was born named, oh, and then one other thing. The Khmer folks that are listening in, Nyum Som To, Nyum So Cha Hye Khmer. I haven't spoken Khmer in about 10 years. So my pronunciation of some words might be faulty. Som To. So anyways, Pol Pot was born named Salat Sor. And he was born to a farmer who owned land. When I look at him and his light skin, I just assume that he's most likely a descendant of elites. Like from the last episode, I talked about that caste system. They had money. They had some coins. And he was not the brightest child in terms of education. He basically, like, he failed, like, exams and tests, and he just wasn't really that great at the books, but he had money. You know, he is well off. He comes from a family with money, so, you know, with money you're able to influence things, like get into different, you know, prestigious schools and such, and not have the best grades. Does that sound familiar yet? So here he is, just failing at life, failing at everything, and decides to go to school in France. So that's also where he met up with individuals who had communist ideology that were Khmer, you know, at the height of communism and the fear of communism. This was also at the, I believe it was the early stages of the Cold War. And I might be wrong, but I mean, it's in this time frame of that the Cold War. And so he's in France studying, failing at everything, failing his exams, but France is like, okay, we're gonna give you multiple chances because, you know, you got some money. Your parents are paying for this, so, you know, you're gonna do better next semester, right? No, he didn't. So eventually, he failed enough that he had to go back to Cambodia, and he like Cambodia again has that hold now, because white supremacy has already taken a hold, and the ways that Khmer people idolize whiteness has already started to infuse itself into the overall culture. And when he came back to Cambodia, he became a school teacher. Yeah, a man that failed college decided to educate people. I mean, that was smart, right? But you know, he has that persona. I went to school in France, so I'm smart. You know, just trust me. I'm very smart, and I'm going to teach the kids how to be like me. Well, I mean, unless you have money, you're not going to be like him. But he was able to maintain that persona of being an educated individual. So he started developing this ideology of, again, communism, and he started to kind of idolize individuals like Stalin and the Marxists, and he didn't really quite grasp the ideology. So he kind of, like, as he was going, he was like making it his own thing, because, you know, the man is a complete idiot. But he like picked and choose like different parts of the like communist ideology and just, you know, went with it. Where he lacked in intellect in schools and stuff, he was great at manipulating the people around him. So he was a charmer. He was really good with the words. He was really good at just making you feel like he was great. He was a con man. And he used every single leverage that he had to convince individuals that he was great. Now, mind you, there was also the World War II. So World War II happened, and French used Vietnamese individuals, as slaves for like war efforts and such. And eventually, the Japan occupied what was called Indochina, and they saw that Cambodia was a great location to set camp. And they forced the French out and gave Cambodia and Vietnam independence from white folks. And a lot of people liked being free, a lot like being free from the dynamics and the power structures of colorism and whiteness. So, like, they got the opportunity to experience the world as their own world, not being owned by white folks. So that started a movement of ideology to now, you know, be independent. And the ideology started to infuse itself with like communist themes. So individuals are trying to become independent, but also didn't really know how. So they just started absorbing different things around them. And like North Vietnam started to have the, you know, like communist ideology. And as France started to lose control due to Vietnam wanting independence, we started to transition ourselves into the Vietnam War, where America decided to join in. Not because, you know, we were allied with the French. We were scared that Russia was going to use this as a rook. This was like a game of chess. Russia was going to have an advantage, some way, shape, or form. And that's one of the bullshit things with history and how we name certain types of wars. The Cold War was called the Cold War because of the conflict between Russia and America. There wasn't a large scale like fight between the two countries, but they had like proxy wars, or some people even call it like little hot spots, like hot spots of where wars were happening, like Cambodia and Vietnam were experiencing death in the hundreds of thousands. And we in the blip in history was like, oh, it's Cold War. It's cold war. Like Americans didn't really die at that time because, you know, not die, but like Americans didn't fight with Russia per se, but it happened in Southeast Asia. Like it just diminishes it makes us smaller. It makes us invisible. It makes us like two thirds of a person. So I hate the word Cold War. But as tensions were increasing, America went into Vietnam and started fighting Vietnamese communist troops. I'm really bad with like the naming conventions for what they are officially named, because people call it Viet Cam and Viet Cong or something like that. Rochester is a very racist city, so I've heard a lot of different words for Vietnamese people. Like some people even call them Japs. Like you don't realize that Japan is not even in that general area. So I always, like, whenever I have that, you know, have to name them, I just develop a blur because of all of the racist terms that I have heard over the many years. But anyways, let's just keep moving. So as America was fighting Vietnam, okay, if you've watched the movie Mean Girls, our king, the king of Cambodia, he always reminds me of like Regina George, the queen bee of that high school. Because not because of like, you know, don't picture him just like walking around in the hallways, like owning everything, but like he was just very like vindictive and manipulative of everyone around him. You know, kind of like, oh my gosh, like cute skirt, where'd you get it? Oh my God, that's like the ugliest skirt I've ever seen. But it was just, he was hanging out with like individuals, like the you know, Khmer government, and just like, oh my gosh, like, did you hear about these other people? They're so bad. And then he would go hang out with those people and be like, oh my gosh, the government is just so bad. He was like manipulating every aspect of like the democracy that was established. And he was just taking sides with everybody. But then like when he's with a specific political group, he would be like, I hate those other people. But then he would go to those other people and be like, I hate those other people. So he used that to become like a neutral country, because America was trying to get him to like join in on the fight. And he's like, no, we're neutral. We're, you know, peace and love. But he did this because he wanted control. He liked the control and to have the power to be able to say, I am the king, worship me. And so this is where history starts to get a little murky, because what I did was I spoke to anyone that was willing to speak about the history of Cambodia. So like I tried to ask questions with my mom, my cousins, friends, their parents, and I always pushed as far as I can go until I realized that they were experiencing trauma, and then I would back away. And I paired that with all of the history that is readily available. And I had to almost decolonize the structures of history in order to comprehend what actually happened. So this is the area where it just gets a little murky for me, and I'm with what is available for me from like oral stories and historical things available to me. This is my take on it. But anywho, so they started, so the government started realizing, American government started realizing that we need to, in order to win this war, we need to have Cambodia involved, because the Vietnamese Communist Party was camping in areas in like farmland and villages and such in the border between Cambodia and Vietnam. And America really needed that strategic placement of Cambodian support. But here is the King Sihanouk, saying, no, like, we're not involved in this. Like, we're not, you guys could like handle this on your own. We're chill. And as this all was happening, Nixon started to bomb Cambodia. And I think that it was carpet bombs in villages and farmland and around the border of Cambodia. And, you know, we don't have the internet. We can't tweet. We can't do anything. In many instances, these villagers don't even have power. You know, we're living in like huts and such. Don't have anything available in terms of electronics. But all they saw was American planes flying above them and just dropping carpet bombs. Bombs that's designed to just obliterate the land. And I think that there were, like, by the time that was all said and done, there was more, I don't know, it was like the tons or explosions or whatever, but there was more destruction or more, basically it was worse than what happened in Japan when we bombed them in response to Pearl Harbor. And people lost. You know, brothers, sisters, uncles, people lost mothers and fathers. It just destroyed the way of life, the way of agriculture. It just disrupted everything. And so a migration started to happen, because America was bombing the shit out of Cambodia in the specific region. People started to migrate. And you know, when great migrations happen, there is this competition of resources. When competition of resources happen, it usually creates aspects of civil war. Like in Syria, when a drought happened, farmers started to move in, you know, into like more urban areas, and it started to develop conflict. And you know, drought and water insecurity wasn't the only piece of what triggered the Syrian war. But you start seeing that migration, those migration patterns, those great migrations. And that's what happened in Cambodia. So farmers started to migrate to the city. Well, the city dwellers are snotty, lighter skinned, looked down on the people that were darker skinned. A lot of the farmers, again, like I said, colorism was a thing. But not just colorism, because the complexion of your skin, like I said, the ethnicity of the individuals were different. There was a lot of individuals of Chinese descent. There was a lot of individuals of like Vietnamese descent. And sometime during this time frame, there was a man by the name of Lan Nol. He decided, you know what? King person, I am sick of your bullshit, and we need a democracy, and we're going to like perform a coup, and you're going to leave. So they did a coup and overthrew the king. The king lost his power, and Lan Nol was installed to be the new leader in forming a democracy. This was a coup orchestrated by the United States. And so, okay, let's backtrack a little bit. So when 9/11 happened, and they George Bush said Iraq is the enemy. I remember this going over the different terrorists that, you know, flew their planes. They're all from Saudi Arabia, but we decided to go to Iraq. And I was just like, this is so, like, history maybe is like repeating itself, or maybe it's rhyming. I don't know what's going on right now. But I mean, I was so young, but I had like Cambodia vibes. Like I was just like, okay, this isn't real. You know, America's great. We are the best, you know, support everything. I'm going to follow this blindly. But then they overthrew and got rid of Saddam Hussein, but didn't really install anything to help the country. And they said, okay, this is for democracy. We're creating a democracy now in Iraq. And that abrupt change in a government system started to create more terrorists than the terrorists that were already there. So by the time like everything's said and done, we have ISIS. So like that is very similar to what was happening in Cambodia. So America literally orchestrated a coup and took out the king, installed Lon Nol. Lon Nol started to abuse his power for the sake of democracy, because we don't really know what democracy was. We had a caste system. We had just been, you know, freed from we were freed from French rule for like 3 months when Japan took over, and then, you know, France took over again after they lost the war. So it was just like disruption after disruption after disruption. So it was just, there was no organization happening. And not only that, Lon Nol was targeting Vietnamese people, Khmer people of Vietnamese descent, and expelling them out of Cambodia and displacing them and throwing them to Vietnam, taking them out of their home and throwing them away, out of the country, get out of here. And that really caused a problem with a lot of people. And that wasn't the only issue that was with Lon Nol. He was like skimming from the top. So like resources that were available to like soldiers and such, he would take a lot of the money, the whatever resources were available, and he would enrich himself. But that made the people below him poorer, or some won't even get anything out of the dowry or funds that are available for the people. And a civil war started to ensue with individuals with the ideology that was starting to develop. You remember the King Regina George? Well, she started going around and trying to figure out how to regain power. And I don't know exactly how this transpired, but he may have worked with possibly Russia and China to figure out how to regain strength so that way he can be the almighty king again. At this time, advisors advised him, you need to work with Pol Pot. Pol Pot, remember Salah Sar, he changed his name to Pol Pot. And the king said, okay, yeah, let's do this. Let's work together. Let's do this. I don't think the king or Pol Pot ever actually met, but the king started supporting the ideology of Pol Pot, the ideology of the people that Pol Pot was attempting to gather, saying, look, Lon Nol is a piece of shit and we need to get rid of him. So he started recruiting. One of the people that he recruited, remember the people up in the mountains, the Khmer Le? He started going after those individuals and saying, hey, your quality of life is horrid. He also started recruiting farmers that lost loved ones from the bombings that America did. And he said to them, hey, America's a piece of shit. They did this to you. Let's get some revenge. Let's get back to a world where we could be great. Let's make Cambodia great again. And he started getting more and more recruits. Get young boys to join in. And over time, he built enough power to storm the capital. And he waited for the right opportune moment, a right time to storm the castle. So they planned and planned and planned and waited for the right time to do this. Now, we were losing the war. America was losing the war. You gotta remember, as I'm talking about this, you can remember I'm still a fucking American, okay? But America, we were losing the war. And we decided, you know, we're going to pull out. We're going to pull out of this war. We're losing and we're sending the troops back home. And Cambodia celebrated the fact that the war was over. And this was, I believe, somewhere in like 1975. I think it was like around April, because I always like think about April as like my birthday, and this is like the time that this happened. So it's like it's always sometime in the springtime, a springtime in America that this happened. But anyways, irrelevant. Like around 1975, they started to celebrate. And at this time, remember that Great Migration, a lot of people now are residing in the capital, Phnom Penh. And as this happened, as people were celebrating, the Khmer Rouge took the opportunity of celebration, and the armies were welcomed into the capital. And they were celebrating. The war is over. The war is over. America has left. We're not being bombed anymore. And hundreds of thousands of lives died. We always have with historians, there's always a disagreement on how many people died. And it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate that we don't know how many people died from America's hands. And America's always downplaying it, like 50,000, but it was like the hundreds of thousands. And it's unfortunate that we don't fully understand it because we don't really teach it at a degree that it should be. We should have like those days of remembrance, like how we have the day of remembrance for what happened in Europe. But we don't. So anyways, sorry, backtracking. Going back to that time, so this time frame of celebration. Okay, so celebrating. And then the Khmer Rouge enter and pull out their guns or point their guns and took over the capital. And Pol Pot had shaped these individuals to commit the most heinous crimes
Pol Pot believed that in order to create a new world, we need to reset the country back to year zero or year one. I think it was year zero. And we're going to rename our country Kampuchea. And we're going to reclaim the power and we're going to make Cambodia great again. Just kidding, not Cambodia, Kampuchea. But what they did was they took advantage of the animosity towards Vietnamese and Chinese. Not China and Vietnam, but the Khmer residents of Chinese descent and of Vietnamese descent. They also had they took advantage. So Pol Pot took advantage of colorism. Because remember, the dark-skinned mountainous people were enslaved and ridiculed and terrorized for hundreds of years, maybe even thousands. No, like I don't think the Khmer Empire really went that far back. Maybe. But I don't have that much knowledge of that. But anyways, they saw this as an opportunity. It's like, you did us dirty. Now we're gonna do you dirty. See, the mountainous people weren't as educated as Khmer Zhen. Zhen in Khmer means Chinese. But like, sorry, see, I was like code switching. But they just decided, like, I don't like you because you're such a horrible person. You've been horrible people. Your people has enslaved our people. Your people hate our people. So your people are going to die. So they singled out individuals of Chinese descent. They singled out individuals of Vietnamese descent. And they executed them. Pol Pot saw education as the enemy. So if you had an education, you were killed. If you wore glasses, you were killed. If you are of religious faith, you were killed. He did not want any of that to tarnish his vision of a country that needs to be great. And those areas that the individuals were executed, so a lot of them were executed on the spot, but they started gathering people and forcing them back into the farm area. Because they saw the city as this disgusting thing that needs to no longer be a thing within the country. So the city was off limits. So they kind of created like a death march. Then they forced individuals back into the farmlands. And the sick and the individuals that were not able to make that journey were killed. So they established camps and had individuals. Now, like the people that they've now taken over, and they started to further filter the process. So a lot of areas, they would start like this process of manipulation where they would say, if you have education, if you have anything that's useful for us, we need you. Angkor needs you. So they refer to now the government as Angkor, like the Angkor Wat, like the in English would be like Angkor Wat, that very massive and beautiful temple. But they refer to the Khmer Rouge government that they are looking to establish and named it Angkor. Now, Angkor also is like, you know, they would say, oh, you don't want to piss off Uncle, or you don't want to do that because Uncle is watching. I'd say that, like, our religion, which is a majority Theravada Buddhism, it is one of the oldest forms of Buddhism. And I always liken it to, I don't know much about, like, Christianity, but when I look at, like, the different aspects of Christianity, I always view Theravada Buddhism as, like, similar to Catholicism, like that Catholic shame, and it builds itself into and ingrains itself into the very structure of the culture. So when they say don't do that because Uncle is watching you or Uncle is going to be upset, well, they're taking advantage of the shame, the shaming process that individuals are already have been accustomed to due to the religious nature of Theravada Buddhism, and the overall culture of Cambodia, of the, like, look up to your government or respect your government, and that gaslighting has now intensified, because before it was like, you know, don't do it. Now it's like, if you don't do it, you're gonna die. So now these individuals are now being put into this process of gaslighting at a level where you have to believe what they're saying, because if you don't, you know what happens. As you were marching, you saw dead bodies pile on the road. As you were watching people get executed on the spot for the stupidest things, you started seeing that. So now you are told, if you have these skills, Uncle needs you. Well, people will be like, yes, yes, me, I'm raising my hand. But those people were brought out to areas for execution because, you know, they don't want those people. They want uneducated farmers to farm the land. And, you know, there were a lot of individuals that understood the dynamics of what was happening, and they understood why they needed to not say something, because if they were to say something, they would have been executed. So a lot of people that were mostly, you know, educated, that understood that dynamics, didn't raise their hand. So now they have established, so the Khmer Rouge. Oh, by the way, Khmer Rouge means Khmai Gaham. It means red Khmai. Red as in communism. And I believe that the name was coined by that Regina George Prince. Sorry, I just can't. Every time I think of Prince Sihanouk, I always think of Regina George from Mean Girls. But that asshat is the person that I believe named the Khmer Rouge. I call them Khmer Gaham. So, like, moving forward, I'm just going to say Khmer Gaham, okay? So, anywho, the Khmer Gaham started to just crumble in terms of structure, because they have power, but they don't know what to do with it. And the leaders aren't they're not like military men. They're, you know, they're just random people. Or there are some military men, but it's just few and far between. So the ideology started to crumble. And depending on where you were at, you had a like absolute tyrant, or you had somebody that was kind of nice but was still like horrible. I mean, you don't want to be, you know, in that situation. But depending on where you were at, the severity of death, severity of punishment was different, because there was a lack of structure. And this is also during a time frame where Pol Pot started to get very, very nervous, and everybody was the enemy at this point. And couldn't trust anybody, and everything just started to unravel. And this is where history kind of gets fuzzy for me. But I'm just going to just jump forward. You know, America helped the Khmer Rouge, the Khmer Kahom. America helped through funds, through like humanitarian aid, but the aid went to the Khmer Kahom. And America be like, oh no, we actually were trying to send it to, you know, like the right people, but the Khmer Kahom got hand of it. But there's documents and just the stories that I've collected, and it just proves to me that America literally helped the Khmer Kahom gain power, helped the Khmer Kahom maintain power. Why? Because they took advantage of the fucking fight between Cambodia and Vietnam. Is history rhyming yet for you? Remember when I talked about France? Yes, America did exactly what France was doing. But this time, this was in like the 80s. So, you know, history doesn't repeat itself per se, but now it's rhyming. So it's just the fights that were happening between the Khmer Rouge, the Khmer Kahom, and Vietnam, it eventually weakened the integrity of the structures that were in place in Cambodia. And eventually, the Khmer Kahom lost power. But, there's a but. Individuals who were in there started to divert into politics. And a lot of there's politicians now, even in Cambodia right now, who were Khmer Kahom, who were doing things to people, atrocious things to people, but are still there. And it's just disgusting to see that these individuals who committed the worst crimes imaginable are running the country still. So when I look at America, I see the stark similarities of what Pol Pot did and what Donald Trump did. So everybody's like, you know, Donald Trump is a fucking idiot, which he is. But I also say he's a genius. Like, he was able to create this structure and this system and convince Americans to hate other Americans. And when I talk about like nationality and the blurred lines between race and ethnicity, he took advantage of that blurred line to make these individuals think that someone like me is not worthy. Someone like me is not an American. I was born in Rochester, Minnesota. I am as much American as anybody else. So it was just like seeing the stark similarities of Pol Pot and Trump, and then seeing my people voting for Trump. And I started pulling data about who Khmer people were going to vote for president. And I'm not sure, because here's the other thing. Data is bullshit. I know I say bullshit for a lot of things, but we don't disaggregate data. So we don't take data, dissect it enough to benefit Southeast Asian people. In Iowa, a lot of the data that I get when I like look at like the Asian population, Khmer people, the population is so small, and there's a lot of other ethnic groups, not even Southeast Asians per se, we're thrown into the group and we're labeled other. I hate feeling like an other. So, you know, I can't tolerate being an other. I can't tolerate the incompetence of data collection. So I say data collection is absolute bullshit and we need to fix that. But Okay, backtracking to, you know, Pol Pot losing power. So he did lose power, and Cambodia is destroyed. Like, there was not, you know, okay, guys, we're you know, this happened for 4 or 5 years, and we're just gonna, you know, we're just gonna pick ourselves back up. But that was kind of what was needed, but we didn't get the resources to help us. You know, America, like, did them dirty. America helped destroy the country, but now didn't really do anything of value to help restore and rebuild. When all this is happening, I don't know exactly how, like, PTSD is a motherfucker, and PTSD really affects both memory and affects the ability for Khmer people to actually talk about this. And my mama never really told me what happened, and every time she speaks, she goes in and out of consciousness when she attempts to tell me what happened. So I, you know, I respect her and allow her to tell me bits and pieces, and I just, like, weave them together throughout my childhood and throughout my adult life. So this is my attempt to recreating what happened with my family. But through all of this, I know that my mom said, you know, we had a truck that we knew was close by. And I don't know if it was like my uncle, but she had like all the kids, and they knew the direction to get to Thailand. And in the dead of night, they all packed onto this truck, and they just drove as far as they could until the gas ran empty in the dead of night. If they were caught, every single person would have been executed. And they just kept going and going and going, and landmines were laid out throughout the roads and stuff. And she said, you know, most likely we may have, like, landed on a landmine. We didn't know, but we just needed out. We needed to leave the situation. And then they ended up in Thailand and lived in camps, like refugee camps. So this is also where time frame is just blurry. I believe she said that they were learning the process of assimilation, but then she went, like, the family was uprooted and sent to, I believe, the Philippines. And she always talks about the person that was trying to teach her how to speak Spanish. I think his name was Felipe. And then they came to America afterwards. So they were uprooted from Philippines and then came to America. And I believe both of my parents just gave up on language. And there's just so much to the trauma that they all had to endure. The trauma of just going through all this. The assimilation process is bullshit. We had to learn how to be white, but we were displaced and put into ghettos and hyper ghettos right next to our black neighbors. They didn't teach us black culture. They taught us white culture. And they did not teach us about the vernaculars. They didn't teach us about the cultures of America as a mixing pot. We were conditioned to whiteness, but we were displaced into areas that didn't have much white people. And that inability for us to properly assimilate and absorb the culture of areas that we were close to really started to create tensions between Black communities and our communities. Because to the Black community, we looked Asian. But we were the new kids on the block. We did not know anything about America. And we started to experience erasure at a different level now, because we absorbed America's history when we landed on the grounds of America. We absorbed the history. We absorbed the tension between Asian communities and Black communities. But we didn't even know what the hell was going on. It's like, I don't even go here yet. But now we're fighting. And it's just, it started to create the history of us and the racial tensions between Black and brown communities. And we were brown. So that is something that in future episodes I will be exploring with individuals, talking about the dynamics of Black Lives Matter, the dynamics of Blackness in America, and our relationship to racism. So, but I'm going to end this here. I thank you for your time on all this. This, like, talking about all of this is emotionally triggering, and my mind usually just wanders off to different places. So I thank you for taking all of the information as it is and absorbing it in such a way. So have a good day. This is De Facto. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today. Please go to defactotk.com. Again, it's defactotk.com. That's defactotk.com. Khmer voices are rarely heard in the political arena. I thank you for dedicating time to learn and grow with me. Please help me grow by sharing this site with your family and friends. Please also like, subscribe, and share my podcast if you find this interesting. I appreciate it. You have a great day.